Welcome to Grass Talk Radio. This show is for people who play bluegrass music and anybody who might want to.
The prison guard shut the iron door behind me.
Howdy, folks. Howdy, and welcome back to Grass Talk Radio. This is going to be a bit of a shortened episode this week because I am still in Hurricane Michael recovery mode. That thing made a real mess of this place, and there's a lot of things to do. So I find my days are filled up with moving big logs and monkeying around with the fences, and there's just literally a thousand things to do. The driveway is still impassable. A few days ago, I ordered the new Tom Ewing biography of Bill Monroe, and I cannot remember the title of it right now. I'll make a point to mention that in the next episode. Tom Ewing, as you probably know, was Bill Monroe's guitar player and lead singer. And during about the last 9 or 10 years of Bill Monroe's playing career, Tom Ewing. And back a few years ago, he wrote a book called The Bill Monroe Reader, which I highly recommend to anybody who claims to be a fan or a participant in bluegrass. The Bill Monroe Reader, that book, is a wonderful book because it is a collection of a hundred plus newspaper articles, magazine, interviews. It's just like this humongous collection of everything about Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. So it goes back to, you know, early Grand Ole Opry programs and songbook write-ups, you know, like the Monroe Brothers, or, you know, some little paragraph written in a book printed in the 1930s, which you're probably not going to find a copy of. And then it goes into, you know, interviews on the radio that have been transcribed, articles that appeared in Pickin' Magazine and Bluegrass Unlimited, and newspaper articles, and just throughout Bill Monroe's entire career, you know, all this press that appeared, well, it's all condensed into one book. Well, it's not all of it, obviously, but it's a selection that Tom Ewing put together of material about Bill Monroe. So I have many of these things. Like, for example, when Ralph Rinsler did his famous interview, I think it was published in, I can't remember the name of the magazine, I want to say Sing Out, maybe. These articles are very difficult to find because, you know, people would get those magazines and they would be lost. And you have to do a lot of research to find these old articles and interviews and early interviews. So Tom Ewing has made it easy for all of us. You just simply get the book, The Bill Monroe Reader, and you have all that material in one volume. It's a great, great resource to really understand bluegrass, because I'm a firm believer, if you cannot take Bill Monroe out of the equation. I'm sorry. You know, if it weren't for Bill Monroe, there wouldn't be bluegrass. There'd be something else, but it wouldn't be bluegrass. Anyway, so Ewing has put out a new book, and it's a, I don't know, 600 plus pages, a biography of Bill Monroe. I haven't received it yet, so I'm not exactly reviewing it or anything, but this goes back to the hurricane. I placed this order on Amazon for the book, and there was a little space on there that says special instructions for driver. And this is what I typed. The driveway is blocked by down trees. Please enter through the pasture 150 yards to the north. So hopefully the driver will find the house, because I think it's scheduled for delivery today, which means when the UPS guy shows up, I'm going to, you know, put down the chainsaw and take a break from all this land clearing and dive into Tom Ewing's new book. And I'll tell you about it after I've started reading it. But anyway, so I'm still kind of in hurricane recovery mode, but I am hung up on this idea of putting out a weekly episode, even though it occurred to me that back, five or six months ago, I said, actually, I'm more thinking about four episodes per month rather than one per week. And October being a longer month, and, you know, if I used Wednesdays, there are actually five Wednesdays this month. So anyway, I just feel like I'm going to put out four episodes per month, and then I can say I've done what I set out to do. So even though I have 10,000 other things I should be doing right now, I thought I'd sit down and record this for you today. And I'm going to get back into some more. I've got some planned episodes where I want to go back and kind of revisit some of the technical side of playing on PA systems and things. I listened back to a couple of those episodes about, you know, playing over other people's PAs and running your own sound. And you know, it occurred to me that there are parts of that that could use some more explanation. So that's kind of what I have on the radar, you know, in the near future. Also, I'm working on some ideas for talking about harmony singing, and also a short course in chords and chord progressions. Anyway, I don't know if I'll, you know, when those are coming, but I've got some stuff on the drawing board, you might say, for future episodes. I also want to get back into the interviews. You know, I had some problems with Skype, who, you know, put out a new version and then it wouldn't run on my computer. Well, gee, thanks, Skype. And then I switched to Facebook and I did a couple that way. And I really want to get back into hearing some other people talk about bluegrass rather than just me all the time. So I'm going to have to probably purchase some sort of portable recorder, because my old H2 Zoom recorder bit the dust. So I don't know. Maybe I'll have to start a Kickstarter campaign or something to raise the funds to buy that portable equipment. Anyway, I've got a lot of things on the drawing board, but this week there's just too much going on. So I was thinking, well, what will I talk about? And there's this story that's been rattling around in the back of my mind for a long time. And I thought I'll just tell you this little story. This is back in the mid 80s, you know, it's probably, you know, if I'm not mistaken, Ronald Reagan became president in 1980. So 80 through 88 would have been Reagan. And then 88 through 92 was Bush. And I'm just taking a guess. I can't pinpoint the date of this thing, but I'm sure that the statute of limitations on any crimes committed has long expired. But I would think this is probably back about 87, 88, 89, somewhere in that ballpark. That's the time frame we're talking about here. So here's the deal. I was playing in Cedar Hill, and when you're playing in a band in a local area, you know, other bands see you and you get to know the other musicians. And from time to time, the phone would ring and it'd be, you know, one of these other bands. And they would say, hey, we got a gig and our mandolin player can't do it. You know, would you be able to come down and play the Corndog-a-rama with us on such and such a date? And so you do these fill-in gigs. In fact, I did an episode on how to be a fill-in player. And, you know, the longer you knock around in a local area, the more often this is going to happen. And I would say also probably, you know, the better player you are and the nicer guy you are and the more friendly you are, probably the more likely it is to happen. But anyway, so this would happen from time to time. It would be, you know, five or six different bands. Once in a while, I would get called to play mandolin, or once or twice gone out on guitar. I would get called on bass sometimes, because this is the stuff they knew I played, and very rarely on the banjo. I think maybe once or twice I did that. And the reason I didn't get the banjo calls was because I wasn't normally a banjo player, so they didn't know I played the banjo. So I wouldn't get those calls. But mandolin and bass, they knew I played that because I would do that in public a lot. So get those calls occasionally. So let me just get to the story. I said this was going to be short. I get this call one day, and these guys have a band, and I know them. I've played with them before, done the very same thing before, a little fill-in gig. Their mandolin player can't do this gig. It's in the middle of the day, and he's got to work. He can't get off work. You know, can you do this gig? I'm like, sure. Where is it? What time? Etc. So the day of the gig rolls around, and this thing is going to be a performance for a local school system. So it's one of the counties around Atlanta, which I won't mention which county it is. And that county had a performing arts center so that all of the schools in that school district would use this performing arts center for concerts, for graduations and special events and art shows and functions like, you know, if they had the symphony come down and play, you know, they would do it there. So it was a big performing arts center, you know, bought and paid with your property tax dollars, and a big giant building with a humongous parking lot around it. So I show up that morning about an hour and a half early, which was my standard arrival time. You know, if we're playing at 12, I get there at 10:30. I show up, there's two cars. This is monstrous parking lot of about 20 acres. You know, just humongous building and a humongous empty parking lot with like two cars at the back. And I go to the very back door, you know, like the stage load-in entrance, little loading dock and stuff back there. Well, the door's locked. Knock on the door, nobody answers the door. I'm like, all right, I'll just sit in the car. Wait for the other guys to show up. So I'm just sitting in the car behind this giant building. And a couple of dudes pull up, and they're actually from another county. So they had to drive pretty good ways. And I think, you know, maybe they were having trouble finding it. It was the first time they'd ever played there. First time I'd ever played there too. So they pull up, and these dudes are a little bit younger than me. And, you know, it's a bluegrass band. It's just one of the bluegrass bands knocking around Atlanta. So we're standing there between the cars talking about what we're going to do and, you know, just talking about the set list and stuff. And then one of them, there was a guy came out the back door of the place and, you know, opened the door and waved us in. I guess he was checking to see if we were there yet. And it was a sound man. So he leads us back through these hallways, and we put our instruments in this room or drop our cases off, get our instruments. He wants to sound check us. So he walks, you know, down these little hallways and stuff. And we go onto the stage from the rear, walk on stage. He's got, I think, two microphones set up on this stage, and it's this luxurious looking auditorium, just a beautiful facility and a humongous, you could put, you know, 150 piece orchestra on this stage, monstrous stage, very tall room. And they got two mics out there, and we walk out and stand around these microphones, and he goes back up to his sound booth and is talking to us through the monitors and wants us to play some stuff. And we do a little bit of old home place or something, just your basic sound check. Nothing too intense, because it's a pretty small PA setup. So we finish that in about 5 or 10 minutes, and, you know, he comes back down and leads us back to the dressing room area, and we're just hanging around back there. And there was a lady around there too, and she seemed to be in charge, you know, had a clipboard or something. And she comes in there and meets the guys and, you know, confirms that, you know, what the schedule is, what time we're going to go on and stuff. So we're just hanging around. We got about an hour to kill. Well, as we're sitting back there, you can begin to hear people coming into the auditorium. There's this little rumble. You can just tell their bodies. There are people, you know, talking, giggling. You know, these are fifth graders, and I guess they're bussing them in. There are probably, you know, 100 school buses pulling up out front and dropping off all these fifth graders. And we're just sitting in the back. You can tell there's something going on, but we still, man, we got 45 minutes still. Well, one of the guys says, hey, I'm going to go out back and smoke a cigarette. So he goes out the door. Well, everybody kind of filed out there, was just standing around in between the cars, just talking and, you know, catching up with each other and stuff like this, you know, talking about the set list and just blah, blah, blah. Well, one of the dudes pulls out a joint. He's got some reefer with him and lights that sucker up and starts passing it around. So comes around to me and I'm like, nah, that's all right. That's all right. I have enough vices. That's always been my policy on smoking pot. I was like, look, I know me. And I know that if you know, that's all I need is one more thing. You know what I'm saying? And that's always sort of been my policy on that. Although I don't care if other people do it. You know, I understand Canada just made it legal last week, kind of legal in a police state legality sort of way. Anyway, it never bothered me. I could care less what other people do, you know, libertarian at heart. Anyway, so these guys are, you know, smoking weed, standing around backstage, and, you know, they finish up. This isn't the first time I've ever seen this. If you're a musician and anybody under the mistaken delusion that this doesn't occur in bluegrass is living in some kind of weird bubble, you know. I mean, I know there are traditional gospel bands and things like this that would be very shocking to, but, you know, it's been my experience over the years that anything you've ever heard about happening in the rock and roll world, I've seen it in bluegrass too. Maybe not to the same extent. You know, I think, you know, when it comes to imbibing in substance, let's just say substance abuse, you know, I would say in bluegrass, it tends to be more alcohol than drugs. But that doesn't mean I haven't seen plenty of drug use in the bluegrass world. I have. And, you know, you just read Butch Robbins' book, What I Know About What I Know. I mean, he's going to just read that book. That's all I have to say, you know. It's, you know, when he's tripping balls playing banjo for, you know, on stage with Bill Monroe, and his banjo neck looks like a cobra or something. You know, this is the way he describes it or something like that. I'm just saying, you know, it occurs. That's all I'm going to say. So anyway, so just to make, you know, just to move on with the story, basically these dudes just decided to get high before they played the gig, you know, no big deal. Seen it a million times. So standing around out there, you know, and then out come the Altoids and they're passing the Altoids around, you know, and, wander back into the green room, dressing room or whatever. Still talking about the set, you know, still looking at our watches. Hey, we got about 5 minutes to go. And pretty soon the lady with the clipboard comes in and they're almost ready for you. And you can hear somebody is on the PA talking, you know, there's talking. You can hear this echoing voice talking. And, you know, somebody is addressing the audience. They have actually started the program and, you know, just be about a minute and we're going to bring you on. And so the lady leads us up to the wings of the stage, and we're standing there, got our instruments around our neck. We're ready to walk on and play some of that good, clean-cut American bluegrass music for all these impressionable fifth graders. And I peek around the side curtain there, just looking out, see how many people are out there. And I see they have a podium, which I didn't notice during soundcheck. There's a podium kind of at the side of the stage, and there's a guy standing at the podium addressing the crowd of wide-eyed fifth graders, and he's wearing a brown uniform with stripes down his pants. He's got all his gear strapped on around his waist, and I see that badge. This guy is the sheriff of that county, and I think he's the sheriff. I don't know. He's definitely dressed like a sheriff and kind of an older guy. So I figure he must be the sheriff. And he is talking to the kids. And I hear him mention bluegrass music. And, you know, I can tell he's introducing us. He's talking about, you know, that good old foot stomping bluegrass music and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't say ladies and gentlemen, but, you know, give a warm welcome to blah, blah, blah band. I don't want to say the name of the band. Cheers and applause, and on we walk, and he's smiling at us, and we launch into, you know, old home place, Foggy Mountain Breakdown. I don't know what we did. The standards, you know, whatever we had on our set list, we launch into. And we finish the first song. And I'm just kind of looking around a little bit, just looking at the size of the stage and taking it all in. And I look over my right shoulder, and up real high across the back of the stage is this tremendous banner, this huge banner. And I look across, I have to twist my neck in order to read the thing. And this is what the banner said. Just say no to drugs. And I could hardly contain myself, the irony of the situation. And I started just giggling to myself about how crazy this is. They have probably selected a bluegrass band. They didn't want to bring some bunch of metalheads on stage to play because the kids would look at them and go, yeah, I'll bet all them guys smoke weed. So they find a very clean cut bluegrass band, you know, and they put them on stage to entertain the fifth graders while they lecture them about the evils of drugs. And little do they know, their innocent, all-American, clean-cut bluegrass band is stoned. Well, at least four-fifths of them are stoned, or mildly stoned. And the irony of this began to just tickle my innards, as they used to say. I began to get tickled, and I would think about that banner and just start giggling to myself. I was just like, this is just cracking me up. So after the next song, I nudged the guitar player and I kind of, you know, pointed with my head like, check that out. And he turns and he reads it and he starts like, you know, he's laughing. I'm laughing. Pretty soon the entire band has noticed that the reason they were hired was to perform at a Just Say No to Drugs rally. And I think the irony hit everybody. And we finished, but it was one of those situations where you can hardly contain yourself. And they probably thought, oh my God, these guys, honestly, I don't think they thought anything. So we finished. We only had to play about 20 minutes, and then they were going to like show them a film or something. I don't know. And we go off backstage. Everybody's just putting their instruments in the cases, and the lady came around with a check and thanked us and stuff, and we went back outside. And I'm telling you, the five of us walked out the back door, and as that big steel door went boom and closed, the five guys just busted out laughing, just uncontrollable laughter for like 10 minutes. And they were like, dudes, I'll see you. Call me. Call me next time you got a gig. And it's like, I'll mail you your check. And off we went. Just say no. And when I would run into those guys over the next few years, I would like to remind them of this gig. And I would say, hey, remember, boys, whatever you do, just say yo. Anyway, that's my little story of Just Say No to Drugs. Y'all have a good week. If any of you have nothing better to do, come on down to my place and I'll put you to work clearing trees from the driveway. Y'all take care and I'll talk to you in the next episode.
With that dram glass in her hand, she's drinking away her troubles and courting another man. Last time I saw little Maggie,
She was sitting on the banks of the sea, had a